Hello and welcome to Chalk Talk. Today we have Jonathan Fenby talking about the French Revolutions.
Thank you very much. Glad to be here and the rain stopped. And thank you for the applause. It's wonderful to be applauded before you've said anything at all. I could just go away now. Right? It was you? Oh, sorry, it was you they were applauding. Yes, come up and do it again. Now, well, you may have noticed I've slightly changed the title of my talk from the French Revolution to French Revolutions, because that is the theme that I'd like to talk about for the next half hour or so, with, I hope, some good stories along the way to illustrate the point. For every country, of course, has a particular kind of way of looking at its history and of presenting its history, and that is very important for the national character in most countries, probably nowhere more so than in France. My new history of modern France, which starts with the Revolution of 1789, makes the argument that, in fact, the French find their history rather a burden. They're always trying to live up to the image which they have of themselves through their history, and they're falling short most of the time. So what I'll be talking about today is a series of revolutions, of revolutionary events, of upheavals, which were intended to put France on a better and generally more progressive path than it had been before, but how repeatedly those revolutions, on the one hand, were countered by, in effect, the counter-revolution, which turned the clock back. The French, this is a terrible broad judgment, of course, which any of you, and particularly if there are any French people here, will no doubt take issue with. But the French like to think of themselves as, or their country, rather, as being, the, as one president put it, a beacon for humanity, the example of the progressive nation, which stands for values of citizenship and the values incarnated in the good side of the Revolution of 1789. But when push comes to shove and they actually have to decide whether they want to be progressive or more comfortably conservative, they usually go for the second option. There's a saying in French, "My heart is on the left, but my wallet is on the right." And that is very often the case, as we've seen through history. So we'll start with 1789, the revolution, La Grande Révolution, the first, if you like, which was caused by a very large number of different factors coming together at that point. And this has been a great treasure trove for historians ever since, because historians can always come up with a new explanation of why actually 1789 happened. It wasn't what the people had said in the past, it was something else. So these range from the explanations from the philosophers of the 18th century, of the Enlightenment, Voltaire, Rousseau, and so on, to the size of the national debt, because France had indebted itself hugely, backing the American Revolution against Britain. And the Americans, having won the Revolution, decided they weren't going to pay their debts back. And that left the French monarchy deeply in the red, in the hog. Other explanations have it that it's the middle class coming together. Other explanations are that it was all down to the price of bread, which went up greatly in the couple of years before the revolution and left a lot of people hungry and unhappy. So we can put all those together, I think, and just say that there was this great ferment in France, ready for the revolution, which, and this is very important in understanding this French Revolution and several others which followed it, was not a planned event. You can say that the Bolshevik Revolution in Russia, the Communist Revolution in China were planned, were led by one person, Lenin or Mao, and were followed the path that they chose. The French Revolution was a mess. It started off aiming for a constitutional monarchy, rather like the British monarchy at the time, but that then fell to bits, and Louis XVI tried to flee France, as I'm sure those of you who've read about this period will recall, was stopped outside Paris, was brought back, lived in a kind of limbo for a while, and then had his head cut off on what is now the Place de la Concorde in France. And after that, The revolution degenerated into the Terror under Robespierre, the first really modern totalitarian regime, which Europe had seen, which was a model for a lot that followed it. That eventually went too far. So we then had middle class, an upper middle class, largely property owners, taking over the revolution and running the regime for their own benefit, very largely. And then we have Napoleon. Coming at the turn of the century, first as first consul and then as emperor. So we have, during this period, from 1789 to 1815, Waterloo and Napoleon's final fall, we have the revolution, which was meant to incarnate the rights of man, liberty, equality, fraternity, etc., etc., ending up in what is basically a military dictatorship. Napoleon gave France many things, particularly administratively and in its legal code, but at bottom he was, as one historian has put it, a general who could not stand aside from any possibility of battle. And that meant that he impoverished France hugely. Probably a million people died as a result of his wars. And when he went finally in 1815, after the defeat by the British and the Prussians at Waterloo, France was ready for a counter-revolution, which came in very quickly with the return of the Bourbon monarchy, to which Louis XVI had belonged, with the rather fat Louis XVIII in blue there, sitting there, who wanted to be a well-meaning English-style monarch, but was constantly being marginalized and outwitted by the more right-wing members of the royal court, his brother, who became Charles X, after Louis XVIII died. And Charles X tried to turn France back to the Ancien Régime, to the autocratic monarchy, with very little success. And so in 1830, we have the Second Revolution, which comes through, which, again, in French history, is put down as being a rising of the middle class and the workers of Paris against Charles X. In fact, it was a pretty small circle affair run largely by lawyers, bankers, and journalists at the time. And that put on the throne Louis Philippe, the citizen king, as he was known, who tried to be a more open, more generous, if you like, monarch than Charles X or Louis XVIII had been able to be, but who quickly fell into basically a context where the upper bourgeoisie were running France. The electorate was very, very restricted. There was an awful lot of corruption. And by 1848, it was time for a third revolution, which occurred in Paris with the people, this time quite genuinely, the people of Paris rising. And it is always Paris. Paris is so important in this story. France is so centralized politically at this point. The overthrow of the citizen king, who fled to Britain and walked up and down the towpath at Teddington, making jokes with a local innkeeper, and died in Britain shortly afterwards. The 1848 revolution brought in what was supposed to be a popular government with actual workers in the government. And that lasted for a few months. The economy got into terrible trouble. There was very high unemployment. The supposedly People's Republican government of 1848 sent in the troops, the Republican Guard, to massacre the workers of Paris. This is an episode which I go into in some detail in my book, because I find it fascinating the way the Republic has turned against the people it's meant to be representing. But it's an episode which a lot of French historians like to gloss over, because it doesn't fit into this narrative of the progressive republic doing well by its citizens. And then after 1848, we then have the counter-revolution with Napoleon III making himself, first of all, he's elected president on the first election by universal suffrage for men only, it must be said, and then he stages a coup d'etat and declares himself emperor at the head of the Third Republic. So yet again, we have this jump from the move to the left in 1848 to, in 1851, Napoleon becoming emperor. He rebuilds Paris with Baron Haussmann. People who like slums say that this was a terrible moment, and that France should have, Paris should have been left in the filthy, disease-ridden state it was. I think actually Haussmann, although he's a profiteer and pretty awful in a lot of other ways, did an awful lot of good and gives us the Paris we see today. Napoleon III tried to introduce some social reforms. He was pushed towards a greater degree of democracy by popular pressure from the middle class in particular. He engaged in some imperial adventures to try to distract people from problems at home, including an attempt to set up an emperor, puppet emperor of his own in Mexico, which led to this great Manet painting. And he then got suckered in to a war with the rising power in Europe, Prussia, which he didn't know really how to deal with. And the French were defeated overwhelmingly by Prussia, with Bismarck running the political side of things. And Napoleon III was forced to abdicate and again came to England and died in this country. And this was an obvious problem for France, and it's been a problem ever since, how France deals with the neighbor to the east, with Prussia to begin with, and then with the United Germany. And this is a theme that runs throughout the modern history of France, and as I'll come back to at the end, is very germane to this day. As you'll no doubt know, the defeat by the Prussians led to the Paris Commune, arising by a lot of workers' leaders, middle-class, left-wing thinkers, whose program, when you look at it, was actually a pretty moderate by modern standards. Anyway, municipal platform, which they put forward. But what they wanted to do, the Commune really, was to run Paris independently of the rest of France. They wanted a left-wing capital which would be able to run itself, which would have its revolution and be its own master. And they saw that the rest of France was pretty conservative, pretty right-wing, and indeed, after a relatively short time, the conservative France, which had pulled itself together by holding a parliament in Versailles, unleashed the army on the Commune, and there was a ferocious degree of fighting in Paris at that time, with atrocities on both sides, which led to the foundation of the Third Republic, whose founding father, Adolphe Thiers, said it was a good thing because this form of republic divided us the least. In fact, it was a pretty conservative republic, again taking over from the left-wing surge of the Commune. There were, of course, no votes for women because the Republican politicians, who were very against the Catholic Church and fought an endless war with the Catholic Church, they thought that if women had the vote, they would be influenced by their priests and it would all vote for right-wing conservative parties. There was also hardly any income tax in France, and it was run very much for the middle-class bourgeoisie at that point. But that said, the Third Republic, Thiers was right in the sense that the Third Republic did not undergo the kind of repeated revolutions which we've seen over the previous decades. Basically, because its politicians were very good at buying off trouble, at catering to vested interests, particularly provincial interests, and to keeping the ship on the road without doing anything dangerous. Above all, Jules Ferry, who was, after Thiers' death, the most important figure in the Republic, and who believed in education as being the glue to hold the Republic together. The village school teacher was seen as the essential missionary for the lay Republic against the Catholic priest. And you have a lot of stories there of the priest and the teacher fighting for the minds of school children in villages throughout France. At the same time, France expanded colonially. particularly in Africa and Asia, which Bismarck liked because it thought it would take the French, the mind of the French, off getting revenge for the Franco-Prussian War if they were allowed to expand. But that again gave a safety valve for a lot of activity which could have been directed otherwise against the Republic. That said, there were challenges. General Boulanger, seen here as a horse, a handsome soldier, threatened the Republic, threatened to make himself a dictator, winning a lot of elections. But when the moment of challenge really came, he bottled out and took the train to Brussels, where he shot himself on the grave of his mistress, a rather ignoble end for this would-be master of a coup d'etat. There was the Dreyfus affair, of course, where the Jewish officer Alfred Dreyfus was wrongly accused of treason, of spying for the Germans, a complete put-up job, which I'm sure you're familiar with, but which divided the Republic absolutely on the lay, church, left-right lines, and was probably the most dangerous moment that the Republic had faced. It then, the Third Republic, survived the First World War, huge carnage for the French, huge economic cost for the French too, particularly since, as I say, the Third Republic had not dared to introduce a proper income tax system for fear of angering its provincial middle-class voters. So France paid for the war basically by borrowing money and came out hugely indebted, hugely demoralized by the enormous loss of life, and really feeling that it didn't want to risk another war, which is a very important reason why the French joined the British in appeasing Hitler. In 1936, we have another kind of nascent revolution taking place when the Popular Front of the socialists, communists, and left-wing radicals won the general election. Léon Blum became prime minister. Huge reforms were brought in, social and economic reforms. Factories were occupied. It seemed that a new revolution was in the making. But within a year, the government ran out of money. The forces of the right were strong enough to unseat it, and France went back into a more comfortable right-wing crouch until the war unfurled on its territory in 1940 with millions of refugees on the road and Hitler triumphant in Paris. The period of collaboration under Marshal Pétain and his Prime Minister Pierre Laval was another of these periods of, right-wing conservative consolidation in France, with the Vichy regime trying to put into operation a lot of very old-fashioned, often quite Catholic religious policies, which never really worked because it was never an efficient enough regime. There was, of course, the resistance. Jean Moulin, the first organizer of the internal resistance, leading to a fresh surge to the left when France was liberated in 1944 with General de Gaulle returning from Britain and Algiers, where he'd been in exile, to head a government which introduced a huge array of left-wing socialist measures of nationalization, of welfare, of the welfare state, and so on, the things which the Popular Front had wanted to do and had not been able to put through. So again, we have this surge to the left, a seeming revolution, but within 16 months, de Gaulle had had enough of this because he couldn't get all the politicians to do as he wished, and he walked out of government in January 1946, went into opposition to the Third the New Republic, the Fourth Republic, as it had become by now. But the Republic itself became, again, a comfortable political arrangement between figures of mainly around the center, some of the left, the socialists, some of the right, the Christian Democrats, but mainly a centrist government, which was devoted really just to keeping the country on the road. Colonial problems, of course, affected France at this time. First of all, in Vietnam, with the defeat at Dien Bien Phu, and then, sorry, I'll go on through this. In Algeria, where the colons, the white, the pieds noirs, the white settlers, not all French, a lot were Spanish and Italian, joined with the army in staging a coup in 1958. And this threatened a new revolution from the right this time. The paratroopers were ready to drop on Paris and take over the government there, but de Gaulle, who was the man whom the coup d'etat people wanted to be their figurehead, refused to go along with them. He played a brilliant game. I've written also a biography of de Gaulle, where following him through these weeks in the spring of 1958 is the most wonderful kind of knife-edged political maneuvering that I know of, where he wouldn't say yes to the army and the people who wanted a military takeover of France, but he wouldn't say no to them either. And by this playing both sides of the street, he managed to terrify nearly all the mainstream politicians that he would in fact go along with the army. And so they actually invited him to come back to power, and he was able to found the Fifth Republic after that. So that was the one moment, Boulanger, you could say, was never really very serious, but in 58, where the revolution might have gone the other way to the right. And then going forward 10 years, we have the next rising, if you like, from the streets of Paris by the students in May, June 1968, rebelling against the Gaullist Fifth Republic, which really just did not understand them. They were on a completely different wavelength. De Gaulle's wife, who was famously conservative, asked him anxiously one day, "Is it true, mon cher Charles, that you're going to ban the miniskirt?" And he said, "Unfortunately, I can't do that." There, she looked very disappointed at the time. So you had the students rising, de Gaulle disappearing, coming back, frightening the country. And at the same time, you had mass factory occupations, general strike, as in 1936. And again, people felt, you know, France was tottering, was on the edge of a revolution, although a lot of people got on with life quite normally at the time. My wife is French. We were living in London at the time, and my wife would ring her parents and say, "Are you all right? Do you want to send us to send you food parcels or anything else? Do you need medicines?" And they say, "No, it's quite all right. The butcher's still open. Everything's still working quite normally," and so on. So this was an important movement, and it certainly had a big effect on the way of French life, with reforms coming out, particularly in education in the following years. But it was very quickly overtaken yet again by a lurch back to the right. The Gaullists, seen here, staged a rather frenetic march up the Champs-Élysées. Elections were held, and they returned the biggest parliamentary majority for the centre-right that had been seen under the Fifth Republic. So the country, which had seemed on the verge of revolution upheaval only about 2 or 3 months before, now went solidly behind de Gaulle and his Prime Minister, Georges Pompidou. We then had a long period after de Gaulle's resignation in 1968, where I'd say that France had a series of presidents, and I won't go through all this in detail, although I'm very happy to answer any questions on it, presidents who really couldn't or weren't able to live up to the quasi-monarchical job which de Gaulle had tailored for himself at the top of the French state. The presidency in France is essentially made for one man, Charles de Gaulle, and it's been very difficult for his successors to live up to the image that the French want to have of their president, or to execute policy as effectively as he could. And this led us to coming to the Élysée of François Hollande 5 years ago, who you've no doubt followed in the press over the recent years, and who very quickly was the object of derision, who didn't seem to know what he was doing, who would lurch to the left, to the right, to the centre, seemed to be all over the place, and whose popularity ratings very quickly fell to 25%, to 15%, to 10%, and then one poll in his last years to 4%. 4% support, which is pretty low for, as I say, somebody holding this quasi-monarchical position there. Meanwhile, you had social tensions rising in France, a lot of tension in immigrant areas, particularly of the big cities, farmers on the road protesting about agricultural prices, trade unions out to defend their interests in a very strong way, and a general feeling that the Republic was, if not falling to bits, at any rate, losing its central threads. At the same time, the rise of Germany, not just as an economic power, but also as a political force, was an increasing existential problem, I think, for the French. De Gaulle had done the bargain with Konrad Adenauer of Germany, which was basically Germany would supply the economic muscle for the European Union and France would supply the political leadership. Well, clearly, by Hollande and Merkel's time, that was no longer the case. If a foreign leader wanted to ring somebody in Europe to know what was happening, what was going to be done, they rang Berlin and not Paris. And this created a, as I say, an existential problem, really, for France to go with all these more immediate domestic social tensions which were rising. Unemployment remained high in France and was not going down. The growth figure was hardly inspiring, despite recovering from the 2008-2009 downturn. Then there were the terrorist attacks on Charlie Hebdo, in November 18 months ago, and in Nice, to round the story out there. There were, at the same time, when Hollande tried to reform the labour laws in particular, there were huge demonstrations. So France found itself in this situation this year, in which it was very unsure of where it was going. People talked a lot about, we need a new revolution, we need a new republic, but nobody knew what that would mean, except for Marine Le Pen, who of course came along and said that if you had a strong authoritarian state in France and got rid of most of the foreigners and got out of the European Union, plus a few other pipe dreams of hers, everything would be all right. And for a while, she seemed to epitomize a certain public mood of disenchantment. But she then, from really the end of the beginning of this year, January this year, faced a more formidable challenger than had been around before, Emmanuel Macron, who came from nowhere. He'd been economic advisor to Hollande, briefly been economics minister, then set up his own party, and got the wind in his sails to an absolutely extraordinary extent this year, helped by two facts. One, that the classic parties in France, the Republicans on the mainstream right, the Socialists on the mainstream left, were falling to bits and had very little appeal and were fighting among themselves, had all kinds of scandals around them. So he was blessed with his opponents. And this meant that at the second round of the two-round presidential election, he would almost certainly face Le Pen, who was bound to get her solid National Front support at the first round to take her through into the second round. And that meant that he was bound to win, because France was still not in a bad enough temper to vote for Le Pen. So we have Macron elected with 65% of the vote in the second round of the presidential election, winning an overall majority for his new party, REM, in the National Assembly, although with a very, very high abstention rate, 57% at the second round of the parliamentary elections, but in a very strong position and in a good relationship with Germany, with Merkel, with a lot of necessary reforms that he has promised to put through, which will be needed for 30 or 40 years. And the big question, which I will leave you with, is whether he will succeed or whether the combined forces of Le Pen on the hard right and Jean-Luc Mélenchon, who is the hard left leader, will organize the classic French reaction to a reforming government, which is massive street demonstrations, and whether we will see a rentrée chaude, as the French call it, a hot autumn, waiting for us. If Macron can get through that, if he can put through the reforms, it may well be that he will represent the next French Revolution. So I'll leave you with that question to watch over the months ahead, whether 2.25 centuries on from 1789, we're about to see a new revolution under this most unlikely of revolutionaries. Thank you very much.
Well, that's it for today, but there's plenty more for you to enjoy at cvhf.org.uk or wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you for listening.